Welcome to CYC Podcast Discussions on Child and Youth Care, episode number 85. I'm Wolfgang Vachon. The folks over at cycnet.org recently published a book called Residential Child and Youth Care in a Developing World. This is the first of a four-volume set exploring residential care from across the world. I highly recommend it for those of you who have an interest in global perspectives of residential care. I was particularly taken with a chapter by Stephen Usembe titled Institutional Care for Children in Kenya. In it, Mr. Usembe offers an insightful, well-supported, and at times seething critique of residential care in Kenya. Although, having read many of the chapters in the book, the situation and issues raised are certainly not unique to Kenya. He brings these ideas, facts, and statistics together through weaving in his own history as a child who grew up in care. The chapter is an engaging and eye-opening analysis that caused me to stop and ponder my own history and current relationship with institutional residential care. Stephen Usembe founded the Kenya Society of Care Leavers in 2009 to support young people leaving institutional care. He's a social worker with two master's degrees and currently works as an advocacy manager of a UK-based organization. Welcome, Stephen Usembe, and thank you for speaking with me today. So we are going to begin with you, if you're willing. You're very, very open about your own history as somebody who grew up in care. Do you think your own experiences as a child in care informs your social work?
Indeed, it does. And also, I'm very happy and excited to be talking to you today.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I grew up in care, and I'll call it what it used to be called then, an orphanage. So it was at the age of five when my mother was killed by her partner, and so me and my two siblings were taken to a hospital, and then from a hospital we were taken to an institution, an orphanage. Mm.
And what was the care facility like where you grew up?
It used to be a large care facility, and we were about 200 children. It was quite huge, and it was also quite heterogeneous, children living with all sorts of disabilities, children from the streets, abandoned children. And I mean, there were also some children who were there who were just neglected. And so I used to live in this one huge dormitory where we were 50 boys, although it was a mixed kind of an institution. Boys used to live like on one end of the compound, and girls used to have their dormitories on the other end of the compound. Mm.
Did you stay in the same institution throughout your childhood and adolescence?
Yes, I did.
Mm. Is that common? And I think in the West, it's very, very common to hear stories of people who live in multiple, you know, 10, dozen, 15 different homes over the course of their life.
No, it's actually the opposite here. Most of the children actually do tend to stay in one facility for the rest of their lives. Mm. And that's what I did. So it was from the age of 5 to the age of 18. So I stayed there for that period of time. But there are also some who get moved, but that doesn't happen often. For example, if a child is found to be HIV positive in an institution with normal children, in quotes, because that's what they say, normal children. Mm. So they might be moved to another institution with children, you know, living with HIV and AIDS. In other instances, an institution can also be closed for malpractice, or if funding comes to an end, this student can also be moved to another institution. So those are some of the instances where children get moved.
You say it's quite rare, and that sounds really great to me. I mean, we know from a Western perspective that multiple placements tend to disrupt attachment with caregivers, tends to disrupt education. what's working that the institute people can stay so long in a single institution, notwithstanding the exceptions you mentioned?
I don't know much of the contents in Euro, but I'll tell you the reason why it's there's also some kind of ownership. When children go in into an institution, they're kind of also owned by the institutional managers. And so, and also they are committed by the court. And so for you to be able to move a child to another facility, then you have to seek court's consent. And so normally it doesn't happen because also not so many people want to interact with the law. And so they tend to actually keep the children within that one facility.
Right. I want to talk more about this ownership of children a little bit later on, because I think it links into some of the critiques that you have of the institution of child and youth care in Kenya. What was your time like when you think back on growing up in residential care? What are your thoughts, feelings, and memories of that time?
I don't have so many happy memories of my childhood, especially in the institution. You know, we lived in an environment where we could only be seen and not be heard. And we rarely interacted with the house mothers. And often when we interacted with the house mothers, all the staff, it was only during chores when they were directing us to do this and do that, you know, clean up the house, make up the beds. Those are the only times that we could interact with them. But also, in a way you could understand, I mean, I lived in a dormitory, 50 of us, and we used to have these, four staff who used to work in shifts. So we had two in the day and two in the evening coming in. And their role was much more limited to helping especially children who are living with disability, you know, making sure that they were cleaned, and making sure that they were changing them clothes, although we also helped out in the same chores. And they also made sure that they washed the clothes, you know, cleaned the dormitories. So the interaction between us and the staff was limited to only these activities. The interaction with the outside world, you know, the walls, the life beyond the facility were rare. This depended normally when we went out, it was only when well-wishers or donors were actually willing to take us out. We saw more of the outside world through a black and white TV as well. We used to have this black television set, you know, black and white then.
Mm-hmm. I remember it was them in well the 90s. From my own childhood.
Yeah, so it was in the 90s, you know. And so they would keep us busy with the TV during the weekends. And also at times I remember sneaking out in the evening, you know, to just go out and watch TV because it was only one in this big institution. And so it was quite an advantage for the dormitory that had it. During the weekends, we would sit in a huge dining hall. And actually, we would be forced to all come together in that dining hall so that, I mean, they could limit our movements within the compound. And it was easy also for them to be able to monitor us. And so they would keep us all in one dining hall, keep the TV there. And, you know, it's kind of also forced to watch it, but we also loved it in a way. Because, I mean, it was the only way that you could know whatever that was going on beyond the walls of the institution. Also, children who are seen to be rebellious then were easily taken away from the institution. So every one of us, I mean, had to be really polite or well-behaved. And so if you were badly behaved, I mean, you'll be taken back to your relatives. And some could actually escape from the institution, especially children who were from the streets. For them, they felt really like it was, you know, like their freedom was quite curtailed. And so most of them actually ran and went back to the streets.
And would they be picked up by the police and returned to the institution, or would the institution not pursue them anymore?
No, you know, at some point, I remember at some point where, I mean, where there were so many. And so, like, in one evening, like 50 of them actually went back to the streets.
Wow.
And so we had to actually, we also who had not run away had actually to also go to the streets and try and find them.
Wow.
Because it would have been a huge issue. Some did accept to come back, but the majority of them actually didn't come back to the institution. But I always say, I felt the way I had lived then, quite caged, and if they were used to, you know, street for them was really an environment whereby they could interact with people, but there was also enough space for them, you know, to move around. And the institution, was so small. You could move from one part of the institution to the other one within 5 minutes. Mm. So I don't think they were used to that kind of life.
No.
So, it was quite something also, because I didn't have an option, because I didn't know even, you know, the distance from where I had actually come from. But one of my siblings also didn't stay long in the institution, one of my older brothers. So he went back home, that's to the rural village.
And did he end up staying there, or was he brought back to the institution?
No, he ended up staying there. And I saw him 10 years after. 10 years after, when one of my brothers, who was also in Tanzania, visited the institution. And abruptly we were told, here is your brother, and you're going to go for Christmas.
Mm.
And so, I was hesitant because I didn't know my brother, that I had, you know, this other brother. And I could recall, yes, I had one brother who had actually escaped. But here there was another one. And the social worker telling me, now, it's now that you have to dress up and go with your brother. And so when I went there, that's when I found him, and he said he couldn't stomach, staying in one institution, that kind of life, and being away from our relatives. So he told me that's why he ran away. Mm. Although it was also quite another experience, because for 10 years, I had never seen them, and I was just being told that they were my siblings. I had lost my mother tongue then, my ethnic language. And so I was speaking a very alien language. It's quite alien. In terms of the institution where I grew up in, it was a different ethnic language. And my parents, my siblings, they all had also an ethnic language. So when I went there and they were speaking also another language, I felt a bit alien. And my sister, for the whole period that we were there, it was around two weeks, couldn't speak with them because she felt like they were total strangers. In a way, I could understand. They say blood is thicker, than water. But at the same time, I feel like, the whole period of separation and estrangement, it meant that I never really felt like they were my siblings. Up to today, I really struggle to really connect with them. They talk on phone. We communicate on phone, although we physically meet. And they tell me, oh, I am your nephew, I'm your niece. You know, others tell me they're my, they're part of the family. But I also feel a bit, it's a bit hard for me to connect with them. Although it's like forcing myself.
Mm-hmm. I can certainly appreciate that. And stories, mm-hmm. We've heard a lot of those sorts of stories here in Canada with the residential schools and people being removed from their indigenous or native or first languages and not being allowed to speak or not being exposed to those languages. You say you were very, very isolated within the institution, and you've written that when you're 18, you're basically brought to town and dropped off. And I've wondered for a while now, how did you end up with two master's degrees and working as a social worker from being dropped off and having never really been exposed to the outside world? What happened between when you were dropped off to, condensed story? We don't have time, but sadly, for the full story. But how did you get from there to two master's degrees?
That's a difficult one as well. for my life that we were really caged. I mean, we used to see the outside the institution, I mean, really. And I mean, we also, I mean, within the environment, I mean, the school was also within the institution. So it even made things even worse. Because, I mean, if you have a school that you walk out of the institution and, you know, go interact with the rest of the world, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, you get to know what kind of life is outside there. Although we also used to interact with, you know, some children who used to come into the institution from the community. I mean, they could tell you all these stories about, you know, what, you know, what lay beyond the institution, which I liked. But in terms of, you know, having two master's says, it's also a bit strange to me that I used to do well in school, basically. And, you know, as a person who has also done, you know, child development, I can tell you, I mean, some people are resilient. I mean, and some people, it could be, yeah, it could be in me that I could do well that way in education. Because I'm the only person who passed the exams, and we were a class of around 25 of us. The others didn't make it. So it was like one out of 25 doing well. And so the institution kind of also felt obligated to help these shining person who did well. And so they were able to take me to do my first degree, that was in social work, which I mean, it was, I felt good, but I felt bad at the same time. And, you know, when I reflect, I see that, you know, young people, youth who had behavior issues, could not be supported at all because they thought they were truants. And that the reason why they were not performing well, I mean, it is them. It was in them. It's their behavior problems. It is them not deciding to be good. It is them not deciding to work hard. And so for me, I mean, I really felt bad that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, because some of them were like, you know, my brothers, they were like my sisters. I mean, for me, in a way, they were like my siblings. And, you know, them being accused that they were, I mean, they were the problem and not even the system. For me, it was a bit odd.
Yes.
And I know I also did well in a way because, I mean, people thought I was so polite, I was so obedient. And so they thought, I mean, he was so polite, so obedient, and so we are helping him. And he was hardworking, and, you know, he was bright, smart. And so that's how I got to maneuver, or, you know, through this whole education thing.
You really capture so many of those things, those elements of, you know, who we support as child care providers. I mean, I often talk about, you know, there's certain young people that I work with that are just a pleasure and a delight to work with them, and the ones that are more challenging and more difficult, they're the ones that people don't support. They don't go that extra mile, and I would also think it'd be hard for you as well to be potentially pointed out, you know, why can't you be more like Stephen? Why can't you, you know, that sort of rhetoric. I want to, you talked about ownership of children, and you talk about sort of being pointed to and almost displayed in what you just said. And you've also in your writing talk about literally being displayed, that you would you as children, particularly the young and the cute children, would have to come together when donors came, and they would take photographs, and you almost felt like you were on display. Can you tell me a little bit about that, and specifically how that is linked to some very concerning practices in the residential institutional care in Kenya?
I mean, when we were in the institution, it was kind of, you know, the institution also wanted donations, wanted funding. And I could see, I mean, people were just coming in and out of the institution, and the institution would always open the door so long as you were bringing funding. They cared less whether these people could have been, you know, abusers or, you know, or there are people, I mean, there were good people coming as well. But at the same time, when I look at it, it was more of, I mean, we were quite objectified. We would be displayed there, would sing for the visitors, and, you know, it was being forced actually to sing for the visitors, dance for them and all that. And I mean, and also at times they would actually, you know, like point out and say, you know, all these are orphans, and, you know, like some of them are, you know, they are from very poor backgrounds, some of them are HIV infected, and they would actually go to an extent of even, you know, like the children who are disabled and the youth would actually be put first on the line so that they could actually be seen by the visitors. And those who are able-bodied, even there were times when we were locked in the dormitory because they wanted to portray you know, like to actually present the children who are with disabilities. And so for me, that was more of, you know, it's another you know, narrative of how children can actually be objectified. And I mean, you feel bad, one, because you don't want to be sympathized, but also you also feel bad because you don't want to be a commodity, because it's basically being commodified. And in a way, you know, the donors and the visitors did fall to the bait. I mean, they feel sympathetic. Some of them would actually look at the disabled children and they would actually cry. And the institution knew this is the way the system works. I mean, people want to see also, you know, children who are disabled or children who are being mentally retarded being helped, you know. And so... And they provided that space whereby people could actually come to the institution and see these kind of people. And people would actually also feel good that they were helping in a way.
Of course.
You know, I mean, also as our society is quite of, you know, a Christian society whereby people from their Bibles help the widows, help the orphans. And if you can actually do that, I mean... provide a space whereby people can actually come and see them, interact with them. People would actually even come to have their birthday parties there. You know, like it's all interacting with the poor, with the orphans and all that.
You say you felt objectified, but there was also literal objectification. You used the term about ownership of children. You've also written about a lucrative local and inter-country adoption market. Could you tell me about this inter-country adoption market and how the childcare system is actually linked to trafficking?
Yeah, I mean, we've had, you know, Kenya is it's a trafficking hotspot in the region. And people do actually establish institutions, one for inter-country adoption, or they did, because now we have a moratorium, which came into place, I think, 2 years ago, in 2014, end of 2014, I guess. And so we have people who see inter-country adoption as an opportunity. I mean, it's a whole industry with a lot of money, whereby people who want to adopt or desperate to have children actually come here, and, you know, they want adoptable children. And some of them, I mean, the Hague Convention is actually such that adoption should actually be really opened up to children who are not adoptable locally. But you find that people who are actually coming to adopt here are coming to adopt healthy children. And healthy children, I mean, can be adopted by the locals. But you find that they open up this kind of adoption to foreigners, and people want to have children who can be adopted. So they go to the hospitals. There have been cases whereby the hospitals working with some of the institutions to actually get children who can be adopted. And some of them also work with the, you know, with the adoption societies, because it's a whole web of what they say, like industry, whereby you have to work with the lawyers, you have to work with the institution, and you have to work with the adoption society. And so children are gathered. I mean, some of them are just like children from communities and with relatives. They are kept into the institution. And when there is a willing buyer, not always a willing buyer, or there is a willing person who wants to adopt the child, the system will work in a very corrupt way to ensure that that child is given to that person.
And where do these, I mean, you talk about the hospital, but where do these children come from? I mean, these children presumably have parents. How do these children end up in the institutions?
Children end up in institutions. I mean, there's so many factors of, you know, why children are institutionalized. I mean, we have children who are disabled coming into an institution. We have children who are living with HIV and AIDS coming into the institution. And we also have, like, children who are abandoned because of just poverty, and children who are also abandoned by teenage mothers. And we also have children who are abandoned because of the, you know, the socio-cultural beliefs. That, for example, some of the communities here in Kenya, if you give birth to a twin, you know, to twins, that's a bad omen. And these children tend to be just abandoned, thrown away. And so all these children end up in an institution.
So is it not preferable? I mean, you talk about your horrible experiences in the institution. Yeah. Would it not be preferable then for them to be adopted rather than spending 10, 12 years in an institution?
Indeed. Adoption is one of the, I mean, better approaches, as well as kinship care. But you find that institutions, in a way, don't want even some of the children to be adopted. I'll give you an example. There are institutions here which actually keep children in a way, and they say they don't. I mean, like they become the guardians forever, and so they don't allow adoption. Or they will tell you, these are our children. It's kind of a thing that comes with, you know, that ownership thing. These are my children, and I can take care of them until they become adults. Right. They only realize that they did mess up when they're adults, and these young people are actually yearning for family connections. And an institution works in a way that children come in and go out. I mean, they also want to maintain smaller children. Mm-hmm. Also because smaller children do attract a lot of funding. And so when they become young adults, it's like, you know, we want to do away with these older group of people, older people, so that we can actually have a group of children who can actually also bring in funding, because also in some instances it's the donors who actually say, we want to support young children, we don't want to support older people.
Is this linked to what you've written about volunteerism?
In a way, it's linked to volunteerism, but it also in another way, it's because when I talk of donors, because we have instances where donors don't want to release, donors are saying, if those children are as poor as we saw when they visited here, they don't want those children to go back to the communities because of their definition of poverty. And so their definition of poverty is quite narrow, because it's, for them, poverty is defined by, you know, they can't access 3 meals in a day, or they're living in an environment that is so dirty. And so these donors actually tell the managers of the institutions, those children should not go, you know, to their communities, because what we saw there isn't what we really think, as good environment for a child. But at the end of the day, you find that these children are denied that opportunity to interact with their relatives, to interact whether with their families, because a donor here thinks that's a poor environment. And so it's also a negation of, you know, a failure to understand that, you know, it's all about holistic development. I mean, children want to belong. I mean, children, yes, want all these other physical things. But, I mean, there is more to poverty than, you know, the physical poverty.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you talk about, yeah. you know, two staff for 50 children, you know, and it becomes about, yeah, keeping things clean. Could you talk a little bit about volunteerism, what it is, and the implications, you know? So let me, you know, as I read the chapter, and it's certainly not the first time I've been exposed to this, but you know, I work at a college, and sometimes we have students who do placements overseas. And I remember talking to some students who were going to do a student who's doing a placement in Vietnam and or Cambodia, sorry, not Vietnam, in Cambodia. And I was very concerned about it, and you know, some real issues. And sure enough, when she arrived, there was significant issues. Can you talk about what is volunteerism and what are some of the concerns with it?
I think volunteerism is basically, you know, it's an interaction between two words. That's volunteering, and the other word is tourism. So people want to go out and do the touring, but they also want to do good. So they travel, I mean, they come here locally or, you know, other developing countries, to do something with the local communities, as well as make sure that they enjoy the tourism aspect of it. And the issue of volunteerism encouraging institutionalization is so rife today, because unscrupulous people who have actually found out that if you have an institution, there's a lot of money that comes in from the volunteer. From the volunteers, or you know, foreigners who come in, and these people actually end up even going back to their countries and fundraising for that institution. And so this is also a lot of, you know, it's dollar money that is untaxed, you know, or pounds that are untaxed, because they don't, I mean, institutions don't pay tax, and it's money that is also not monitored. And so you find people who tell you, I would like to start an orphanage. And one of the fundraising mechanisms or approaches is actually getting to know how you can work with the tourism funds as well locally to offer that kind of opportunity for them to visit the children, see poverty as well, interact with the children, and, you know, also have some fun time, as you also get an opportunity for you to tour around. And so there are all these institutions. I mean, Kenya at the moment, we have more than 800 institutions, and there are fears that we could be having even another 800 of unregistered and non-institutions. I mean, there is a lot to do with supervision and monitoring of institutions. I mean, we are doing badly at that.
And so what's the concern with volunteerism? Because what you've said so far, you know, seems okay, right? So you have, you know, people coming, they're giving money, they're spending time, they're learning about issues, international issues, learning about poverty, they're going back, they're raising more funds. What's the concern with that?
The major concern is that children are actually, you know, harvested or, you know, disembedded from communities. Children with families and, you know, children with relatives, with guardians, are taken away from the communities, brought into the institution in the name of their orphans. Some people have gone ahead and called them paper orphans, because the institutions actually claim that they are orphans when they are not. Mm. That's one. But children are also separated from their relatives and kept in those institutions for a long period of time. And it even becomes so hard for them to be reintegrated back to the communities. Some of the institutions do well in terms of material provision. And that's the kind of love that some children see that more as love, and they see that more as care. And when they are being taken back to the community, back to their relatives, they think they are going back to a horrible place. Some of the children would actually tell you, no, I want to stay in the institution because there is electricity, there is chicken, and at times we go even on weekends for swimming and all that. And when we go back to our communities, we have to fetch water from the river, and, you know, we miss 1 million a day. But you see, it's also a narrow view of a child, but it's their understanding, which, I mean, we must appreciate. But what we are also saying is that these children, if anyone wants to fund they can actually fund that poor family. You know, you can actually improve the welfare of that family to make sure that the child is actually enjoying and beyond the physical needs, that they can actually be with their family. They can feel that they belong. And when they grow up, they actually tend to appreciate that more, because we've seen young people who've grown up in institutions, and they will tell you, majority of them, they will tell you, what I missed most was that connection, you know, with my family. Now I feel like I'm an island, I'm alone. And so there are these factors of removing children from the community, but there is also another factor whereby some of the institutions are actually taking care of very vulnerable children. The children, you know, from adverse backgrounds. These are children who've been abandoned, or these are children who've been abused in communities, or children who've been neglected. And these, you're bringing in people who are strangers in a way to the children to actually interact with these children. And so there are attachment issues. So they connect and disconnect. Mm-hmm. And so these children are actually in that cycle of being connected to foreigners, to strangers, and being disconnected from them. I mean, what happens? At the end of the day, these children are developing trust issues. I mean, they're developing issues to do with relationships, you know, getting used to people coming and going in their lives. At the end of the day, I mean, they are totally emotionally and socially deprived, or actually the ability to also trust people, you know, develop trust in relationships. These are all, in a way, destroyed. And we've also seen serious cases. For example, in 2014, there was a missionary from Oklahoma coming into Kenya and, having sexually exploiting children in one of the institutions. I mean, over, I think, 15 children were reported to have been sexually exploited by that missionary. We also had the British pilot in, you know, a case whereby it was all over the news again, even in CNN and all that he had actually also sexually exploited some of the children. It's a sad situation because institutions, in such a way, their primary focus is the funding. And because they are also so unsupervised, and we have also quite unscrupulous people, anyone willing, if you want to give something, they open up the doors of the institution and you're allowed in. So it's a bit of a system. If it's not well monitored, it allows in so many issues, and I mean places children at a very vulnerable position, whereby children can't talk in institutions. I mean, I'm telling you, I grew up in an institution whereby you couldn't report being physically, sexually, or emotionally abused because you couldn't go. I mean, you can't report to anyone outside the institution because you're not allowed to leave the institution. So the cagey position that you're put in, that contained position, your voice is quite stifled, such that if anything happened to you, you have to live with it.
Right.
And you can only maybe talk about it when you're older, or you can even, I mean, when even older, you become ashamed of talking about it. And so, I mean, children end up, you know, in their whole lives, they become, you end up becoming like a person who fears telling people things, also because of how you are brought up. And also you're at a position whereby you think you're a grown-up and you can't start talking about the abuses that happen when you're a kid. It doesn't happen in our culture, that people really don't talk about personal issues in our culture. And so it's even bad when bad things that have happened to you.
I think you've really articulated very, very well some of the significant issues around, adoption, around volunteerism, through your own lens and your research and your advocacy work. And I want to reiterate that this certainly is not unique to Kenya. This volume presents a variety of perspectives and that I referred to beginning Global Perspectives on Child and Youth Care provides a variety of perspectives and certainly issues of adoption and orphanages are not unique to Kenya, not unique to Africa, not unique to South Asia, and it really does spread around the world. I want to thank you so much for writing the chapter you did and for taking the time today to speak with me. I think it's so important that we look at what it is we do when we say we care for children and how we interact internationally when we travel. I've watched many young children in many countries sing and dance for me as I visited institutions around the world in my career. And as I look back on all those moments, I have sadness and discomfort, and it really forces me to reflect and look at, you know, how am I contributing to this abusive system. So thank you for taking the time with me today, Stephen.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
This concludes this month's episode of CYC Podcast. Tune in next time for more discussions on child and youth care. Subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher. Visit us on our website at cycpodcast.org. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/cycpodcast.